Chapter 16. In the afternoon, I groped west along the hill. 30 or 40 feet from the last palm tree, I began to dig a grave for Timothy. I cleared palm fronds, chunks of sea grape, pieces of wood, dead fish, fan coral, and shells that the sea had thrown up. I marked out a space about 7 feet long and 4 feet wide. Then I dug with my hands. At first, I was angry with Timothy. I said to Stewcat, "Why did he leave us alone here?" Then, as I dug, I had other thoughts. With his great back to the storm, taking its full punishment, he had made it possible for me to live. When my grandfather died, my father had said, "Philip, sometimes people die from just being very, very tired." I think that is what happened to Timothy. I also think that had I been able to see, I might not have been able to accept it all. But strangely, the darkness separated me from everything. It was as if my blindness were protecting me from fear. I buried Timothy, placing stones at the head of the grave to mark it. I didn't know what to say over the grave. I said, "Thank you, Timothy," and then turned my face to the sky. I said, "Take care of him, God. He was good to me." There didn't seem to be anything else to say, so I just stood by his grave for a while. Then I felt my way back to the spot where our hut had been. I located wood and piled it around the base of the palm tree that held our water keg and the tin box. Both were to the lee side of the storm. It took me a long time to get the keg and the tin box to the ground, but I found, on opening the bung, that the water was still sweet and that the matches, wrapped in cellophane inside the tin box, were dry. But the two small bars of chocolate that we had been saving for a feast were ruined. I had no taste for them anyway. Feeling it everywhere under my feet, I knew that the quay was littered with debris. I started cleaning the camp area, or what was left of it. I piled all the palm fronds, frayed by the wind, in one place, sticks of wet driftwood in another. With Stewcat constantly around, I stumbled over him several times. I worked until I felt it was nearing darkness. I found one lone coconut in a mass of sea grape and broken sticks. I opened it and ate the meat, offering to share with Stewcat, who didn't seem interested. Then I made a bed of palm fronds and sprawled out on it, listening to the still angry sea as it tumbled around the damp quay and thinking, I must feed myself and Stewcat. I must rebuild the hut and build another signal fire down on East Beach. Then I must spend each day listening for the sound of aircraft. I knew Timothy had already given up on any schooner entering the dangerous Devil's Mouth. I was certain that the sea had washed away Timothy's markers atop the coral reef, and I was also sure that my guide vine rope leading down to the beach had been snapped and tangled by the storm. But now, for the first time, I fully understood why Timothy had so carefully trained me to move around the island and the reef. The reef, I thought. How could I fish without any poles? They must have been washed away. Then I remembered Timothy saying that he would put them in a safe place. The trouble was he'd forgotten to tell me where. I got up and began to run my hands over each palm trunk. On one of them I touched rope. I followed it around to the lee side with my fingers. And there they were, not two or three, but at least a dozen, lashed together, each with a barbed hook and bolt sinker. They were one more part of the legacy Timothy had left me. The sun came out strong in the morning. I could feel it on my face. It began to dry the island, and toward noon, I heard the first cry of a bird. They were returning. By now I had taught myself to tell time, very roughly, simply by turning my head toward the direct warmth of the sun. If the angle was almost overhead, I knew it was around noon. If it was low, then of course it was early morning or late evening. There was so much to do that I hardly knew where to start. Get a campfire going, pile new wood for a signal fire, make another rain catchment for the water keg, weave a mat of palm fibers to sleep on, then make a shelter of some kind, fish the hole on the reef, inspect the palm trees to see if any coconuts were left, I didn't think any could be up there, and search the whole island to discover what the storm had deposited. It was enough work for weeks, and I said to Stewcat, I don't know how we'll get it all done. But something told me I must stay very busy and not think about myself. I accomplished a lot in 3 days, even putting a new edge on Timothy's knife by honing it on coral. I jabbed it into the palm nearest my new shelter, so I would always know where it was if I needed it. Without Timothy's eyes, I was finding that in my world, everything had to be very precise, an exact place for everything. On the 5th day after the storm, I began to scour the island to find out what had been cast up. It was exciting, and I knew it would take days or weeks to accomplish. I had made another cane, and beginning with East Beach, I felt my way back and forth, reaching down to touch everything that my cane struck, sometimes having to spend a long time trying to decide what it was that I held in my hands. I found several large cans and used one of them to start the time can again, dropping 5 pebbles into it so that the reckoning would begin again from the night of the storm. I discovered an old broom and a small wooden crate that would make a nice stool. I found a piece of canvas and tried to think of ways to make pants from it, but I had no needle or thread. Other than that, I found many shells, some bodies of dead birds, pieces of cork, and chunks of sponge, but nothing I could really put to good use. It was on the 6th day after the storm, when I was exploring on South Beach, that I heard the birds. Stewcat was with me, as usual, and he growled when they first screeched. Their cries were angry, and I guessed that 7 or 8 might be in the air. I stood listening to them, wondering what they were. Then I felt a beat of wing pass my face, and an angry cry as the bird dived at me. I lashed out at it with my cane, wondering why they were attacking me. Another dived down, screaming at me, and his bill nipped the side of my head. For a moment I was confused, not knowing whether to run for cover under sea grape, or what was left of it, or try to fight them off with my cane. There seemed to be a lot of birds. Then one pecked my forehead sharply, near my eyes, and I felt blood run down my face. I started to walk back toward camp, but had taken no more than 3 or 4 steps when I tripped over a log. I fell into the sand, and at the same time felt a sharp pain in the back of my head. I heard a raging screech as the bird soared up again, then another bird dived at me. I heard Stewcat snarling and felt him leap up on my back, his claws digging into my flesh. There was another wild screech, and Stewcat left my back, leaping into the air. His snarls and the wounded screams of the bird filled the stillness over the quay. I could hear them battling in the sand. Then I heard the death caw of the bird. I lay still for a moment. Finally, I crawled to where Stewcat had his victim. I touched him. His body was rigid, and his hair was still on edge. He was growling, low and muted. Then I touched the bird. It had sounded large, but it was actually rather small. I felt the beak. It was very sharp. Slowly, Stewcat began to relax. Wondering what had caused the birds to attack me, I felt around in the sand. Soon my hand touched a warm shell. I couldn't blame the birds very much. I'd accidentally walked into their new nesting ground. They were fighting for survival after the storm, just as I was. I left Stewcat to his unexpected meal and made my way slowly back to camp.